Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast. Relevant and engaging content designed to help you dominate the day. Are you a passionate surgical educator with something to say? Then join Behind the Knife and let the world hear. Behind the Knife is the number one surgery podcast in the world, with each episode reaching 20,000 listeners. Our current group of subspecialty teams have created incredibly diverse and engaging content, but their commitments are nearly finished, and we want to open up the opportunity to all of our listeners. We're looking for teams of 3 to 4 surgeons who will develop one new subspecialty podcast every 4 months. To learn more, check out the show notes or contact us at hello@behindtheknife.org. Applications are due February 13th. Welcome back to Behind the Knife. This is Patrick Georgioff, and I am joined by Kevin Canary. And today we have two very special, very funny guests, the king and queen of medical comedy. I want to play a little teaser here. I think you might recognize this.
Good morning, doctor. We have a new med student working with us today.
Hi, I'm excited to be here.
We're happy to have you. Please be nice.
Of course I'll be nice. Like, don't let them scare you. I'm not like the other surgeons, all right? I'm really easygoing.
What's the blood pressure doing?
Okay, make it better, please.
Can we check the blood pressure, please?
The patient's moving. Why is the patient moving?
Look, I only get paid to do my job. Don't expect me to do yours, too.
Bed up.
Bed down.
Put the bed exactly where I want it, please.
Reverse Trendelenburg.
That's regular Trendelenburg. I need reverse Trendelenburg.
Dr. Trendelenburg is rolling over in his grave right now.
It's way too hot in here. Turn the temp down, please.
It's not as low as it can go. Make it colder.
Well, then call HVAC and tell them to make it colder.
I'll tell you where the money went. Right into hospital administrators' pockets.
Hey, where's the music? Let's get some music playing.
Oh, turn it up. I love this song.
Music's way too loud. I can't hear myself think.
We are thrilled to welcome Dr. Will Flannery, a.k.a. Dr. Glockenfecken, and Kristen Flannery, a.k.a. Lady Glockenfecken, to the show. Will is a practicing ophthalmologist and social media personality with over 4 million followers. During his third year of medical school, he was diagnosed with testicular cancer, and he began using humor as a coping mechanism. Following a second bout with cancer 3 years into his medical career, he created a Twitter account under the pseudonym Dr. Glockenfecken, because it is, according to him, arguably the funniest word in all of ophthalmology. A cardiac event and near-death experience in 2020 only fueled his creativity. Kristen, meanwhile, is formally trained in cognitive neuroscience and social psychology and now works in marketing and communications. Kristen is best known internationally as her social media alter ego, Lady Glockenfecken, where she shares stories from her unique perspective of the healthcare system. She has been a patient, married to medicine through the entire medical training journey and beyond, and a lay responder and CPR provider to her husband. She's also a caregiver and co-survivor of his 2 cancer occurrences and sudden cardiac arrest. And if that's not enough, they have also a brand new podcast called Knock Knock High, where they discuss quirky and unexpectedly hilarious medical stories. All right, welcome, Kristen and Will. We have a very important first question for you, Will.
All right, I'm excited.
Ophthalmologist surgeons.
I knew you were going to ask me this. I suspected it because I was kind of surprised. Like, you're going to bring an ophthalmologist on a surgical podcast, because I know that, you know, there's a little bit of, you know, like, are they real surgeons? I'll tell you this. In some respects, yes, we absolutely are real surgeons.
Okay.
In the fact that if you need someone to operate on your eyeball, all right, you want an ophthalmologist. I don't think you want anybody else. All right. But if we're talking about the, like, perioperative care that you expect in, like, a hospital where you're, like, managing, like, incisions and like doing a bunch of post-op checks and patients are admitted, then absolutely not. We are not real surgeons. But I think overall, I consider myself an ophthalmic surgeon. Yes.
This is important to know. Yeah. And I want you to know, just the other day, we had we were in the trauma bay and we're seeing some consults, and one of the residents very proudly pointed out that they had spotted the ophthalmologist walking towards the other bay and went running after them to hunt them down for one of our trauma surgeons because it involved the eyeball and everyone was at a complete loss.
That's a rare sighting. We don't get into the hospital very often. So that's good. You make a wish when that happens, by the way. Yeah.
So
here's a question for you.
Yeah.
Do you consider us surgeons?
Oh, I'm going to let Kevin answer that one.
Oh, vascular surgeon. That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Many of my friends actually chose ophthalmology. Like my tightest group, my fantasy football league from med school is actually like 3/4 ophthalmologists. And they're all very happy with their life choices. But yeah,
they can play all the, they can keep tabs on their team. Meanwhile, yours is falling apart and tatters after you take your,
You can consider ophthalmology whatever you want. I have better work-life balance than you. So
vascular surgery actually that convinced him to go into ophthalmology.
Yeah, that's true.
And how was that?
Well, my core rotation as a third year med student was in vascular surgery. I was just assigned to do 7 weeks of vascular. And, I liked being in the operating room. I thought that was fun, but, I'll be honest. I hated that rotation. It was, you know, like very sick patients, lots of blood, late nights, like the opposite of ophthalmology in every conceivable way. and I just remember this was like my last rotation of third year. I was standing in the corner of the operating room, like behind trash cans, because often that's where you end up as a med student.
Deposited in the corner.
Deposited there. And I was wearing, you know, the 20 pounds of lead or however heavy those things are, standing for hours, all right, motionless. And it's just like I was, you know, dying. I was sweating, and it's like I'm not doing anything. Why am I here? And it is listening to the vascular surgery attending talk about their favorite brand of compression stockings and just thinking there has to be a better way to do surgery. Like
Kevin has a whole collection of
this. I know you do because you've got horrible venous insufficiency. I know you after however many years you've been a surgeon. And then I immediately left vascular surgery and I started a 2-week elective in ophthalmology that I had planned. And my first day walking into the operating room, I was offered somewhere to sit.
The and angels that was were it. Singing and they were raised with sunshine.
Exactly. And that was
Teddy Bears dancing off in the distance. And
I was like, I'm sold. You're also going to let me go home at a reasonable hour. Sign me up. I'll be an ophthalmologist. So honestly, that's really like a big part
that's
of
actually how
it.
It
was like
there.
The difference between the two experiences that really sold me.
Well, I'm glad vascular could play such a large part in your career choice.
Yeah, do you think thank you.
Would you have had the time for the comedy had you not gone into ophthalmology?
Fair point.
No, people ask me that, and no, absolutely not. Like I would have done something. I probably would have had some kind of social media experience, but there's no way I could do all like the filming of this, all these skits and these videos and writing, all the time it takes to make those if I was in another career in medicine. So I think it's because I'm in the job I'm in the field I'm in that really allows me to explore that creative side.
So in talking about your observations from surgery and standing in the corner with heavy lead on, you're obviously a huge part of your success is a just extraordinarily on point satire of the different specialties, just to the T. And so when you think about, when you talk about writing and creating these skits, when you think about surgeons,
yeah,
what do you think about? What are some things that come to mind?
I'm thinking about specifically some of those vascular surgeons I worked with. Like that's my benchmark because that was my first like real surgical experience. And they were like old school vascular surgeons. They were in their like, you know, late 50s, 60s. And this was, you know, in 2010 or something like that. So, and they were grumpy and kind of, you know, threw their weight around in the OR. And so all the things in the easygoing surgeon, like a lot of those are kind of jokes in the video I made about the easygoing surgeon. you know, it's not too far off, to be honest, from a lot of those interactions I had. And also in ophthalmology, we had a couple of
They're going to get mad at me if they hear this, but we had a couple of oculoplastics surgeons that were kind of on that spectrum as well for like, you know, kind of your classic typical surgeon.
Sure.
That's how it goes. And so you're talking about ophthalmologists and whether or not we're real surgeons. Well, if you talk to an oculoplastic surgeons, they're not ophthalmologists. They are surgeons. That's where the difference starts right there is when you're talking to an oculoplastic surgeon who does 1,000 blephs every day. So
Will, one question I had was, you know, how has COVID impacted this and how do healthcare providers respond to humor and kind of what role does humor play in the day-to-day lives of providers?
So COVID, I didn't start doing all these videos until lockdown. So I was just on Twitter. I had a following on Twitter, but then our practice shut down and someone had mentioned, hey, you should check out TikTok. I bet you could make some funny videos. And I checked it out and I started making videos and it just kind of kept going from there. And it was new and it was exciting. It was fun. And I think, and it's just grown in popularity from there. Now you see a ton of people, a lot of people in medicine that are making really good content, really good video content. And it's important for physicians to explore that side of themselves, that all that humor, because it's been there for a long time. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, that's how doctors and other people in healthcare who see some pretty horrible things and have to experience some really, you know, terrible things in medicine, that's how we cope, right? But most of the time it's like, you know, in physician workrooms or in the break rooms or locker rooms or whatever. And I think we should be showing that side of ourselves, like to the public safely. Like we got to do it in the right way, you know, and that there's rules that I follow whenever I'm on social media where, you know, not making fun of patients and just, you gotta be careful because as physicians, we do have to maintain a level of professionalism on social media, but I still think we can and should show off our senses of humor and show people, hey, look, you know, we're just regular people. You know, we're all surgeons, we're doctors and we have that side of ourselves. And I think it's helpful for people to see that, to know that we're not just like, you know, machines that, you know, can stand and do a surgery for 10 hours wearing our compression stockings.
So, Kristen, you guys have had this really, I would say, meteoric rise on social media. You guys have an insane number of followers. But social media is a double-edged sword, really. And
yeah.
I'm sure you have some horror stories and some downside to it, too, because it's not all sunshine and rainbows, is it?
No, you have to have a thick skin going in to social media. And I think also just a really solid sense of yourself and what you're doing there and why this is the place to be to do what you are trying to accomplish. But also I think just knowing that I don't know, the trolls, sometimes they can get in your head, but also they're just like, they're easy to write off as well because you know they're not there to actually contribute anything meaningful or get something meaningful out of your content. They're just generally hurting people, right? So it's kind of easy not to take it too seriously as well. But yeah, you hear people say all sorts of things about, you know, whatever you're saying, and most of the time, nothing to do with what you're saying. You know, especially noticing on this podcast where it's he and I together, a lot of people comment on things about me, but not so much him, right? Like I'm noticing some misogyny in the in the comments. And a lot of it has to do with either my looks or that I should talk less, right? There's a lot of like, let the doctor speak kind of attitude. I shouldn't say there's a lot. 99% of the comments are great and people are there for the right reasons and they're wonderful. But you know, of the ones that are saying negative things, that's kind of the flavor So that's unfortunate, but it also makes it that much easier to write off because I just feel like, well, that's misogyny and I'm not here for misogyny. So
it's almost unavoidable, you know, and I, you know, I've been putting videos out and getting feedback for, you know, years now. And it's, it's pretty easy to know what's constructive feedback that's actually going to help you and what's not. And
how much of it is constructive?
Well, no, I mean, because especially when we, you know, are starting this new podcast or people have ideas.
Yeah.
For people have ideas for me for videos or things that my characters like they'd like to see them doing, like that kind of stuff is actually really helpful sometimes. And I do get ideas from.
It's basically free market research.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, we like to hear
what
they would like to hear and what they're enjoying and what they're not enjoying as much. And
yeah,
you know, it helps us make it better for everybody. So there is, I would say the vast majority of people are very respectful and lovely. And even when they're offering suggestions, they're doing it in very nice ways.
But the bad ones are pretty bad. So that's kind of a big, you know,
yeah, but you just kind of know that going in and you have a thick skin and you got to brush it off, you know.
So you just block them at that point. Seriously.
Yeah. What's that?
We just block them quick, you know, quick to block.
Oh, quick with the block button. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Removing comments, you know, especially ones that, you know, are really just.
If it's just mean, then
just mean.
It doesn't belong, right? Yeah. Like if there's some constructive criticism, we're open to that. But if it's just an insult, there's no need for it to be there.
Yeah. Social media is so bad that we don't even get a lot of comments or feedback or something when it comes to it. So you guys are masterful.
Well, people have a lot of opinions about strong women who have things to say. So
it's true. And it makes me angry when I see that. But then the other thing is, do you respond? And you know, because there's that and Twitter's, you know, Twitter's a platform where you can really get sucked into some of these, you know, troll type comments. And what I've learned is when to respond, when it's worth it and when it's not. Because sometimes it is worth it to, hey, point out, hey, this is not the correct way of thinking or this is really hurtful and you know, but sometimes, and especially as our platform has grown, sometimes drawing attention to it just makes it worse. And
you gotta treat it kind of like a toddler, right? You pick your battles, and is this important in the long run? Then I'll address it. Is this just a temper tantrum? Yeah. Let it blow over.
Exactly.
Keep moving.
So Will, something some people don't know about you is that you survived testicular cancer, not once, but twice. Can you tell us how that changed your outlook on life and did that change your career trajectory?
Yeah, it made me realize, you know, like testicles aren't that important. Like, I mean, let's be honest here. Like you could do just fine without them. I mean, I'm riding a bike has never been more comfortable. Like seriously, you don't need them. Like they serve some importance,
huh?
Purpose, but for the most part, you know, you can live a normal life without testicles. Okay. But the experience of going through cancer as a young person did have a big impact on me. And because it's a very isolating, lonely experience, because that's not what you expect to be doing when you're, you know, 25, 26, and you're hanging out in waiting rooms for hours, you know, looking at people who are three times older than you.
The brochures they hand you are for that, like, age group.
Yeah. There's always people in their 60s, 70s, 80s on these brochures and stuff and on the, all the pictures on the walls and everything. And so it's just like constant reminders that you're too young for this. And actually it was my cancer experiences that really taught me the importance of comedy. And because at that point in my life, when I was diagnosed, I had gone away from stand-up because I'd started doing stand-up comedy in high school and college and as a hobby, basically. But I was getting pretty good. I was having just a little bit of success, nothing major. But then I got away from it when I started getting into my clinical rotations. But then I had this cancer diagnosis and I was like, I felt that urge to like get back out there and start telling jokes again and really just dealing with all the thoughts and the feelings that I was having surrounding that diagnosis. And it helped, you know, it really, and it's such an incredible coping mechanism. And that's why there's so many funny people in medicine and why it really is something that we should all embrace, because that's using humor, both in my, you know, obviously in my, you know, content, but also just in my day-to-day life, you know, using it with patients. Now it's different with patients, but you know, it's all like dad jokey type of stuff, you know, but still it's important.
So Will, I have two follow-up questions that are maybe a little personal. You know, was it just, you felt a mass on your testicle? Like what was it? And then the other question is I know you guys have kids. How did that play into this timeline and how did that work? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
He's very good at feeling his testicles.
So. Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's,
he had a lot of practice with that.
I felt it myself. Yeah. I had to like convince myself that it was actually like a real, yeah. It's so easy when you find something like that in your body to like explain it away. Like, oh, that's probably the epididymis or, you know, and so there was some of that for like probably a week. And then I was like, you know, obsessively feeling this nodule on my testicle. I was like, okay, this is definitely not right with the prospect of, you know, infertility. And so, right. It wasn't as difficult. It was still really difficult having to decide, okay, do I bank sperm? Do I not, you know, are we done? Is our family complete? And I did bank sperm for, a couple of years. Very expensive process. It's really also interesting what they do with your sperm after you like you give them, like you literally hand the specimen cup like to this other person. Very strange all the way around.
Do they judge you when they look
the
at
whole,
it?
You know, I don't think it was kind of like one of those. I didn't want to look the person directly into the eye as I handed them a cup of my own semen.
Absolutely.
I don't know exactly what they thought at the time, but I was like, oh, they probably do this like, you know, 40 times a day. I'm sure.
Sure.
What an interesting job that would be anyway. And so it's, what they do though, is you can pay extra to have it be sent on different trucks.
Oh, no shit.
Yeah. Like to the storage facility. Because like if, I don't know, the truck driver has an accident and there's, you know, sperm all over the highway, then at least you have some of it in a different truck. And all of this is crazy expensive, too.
So it's did you spring for the luxury?
I did not. No. I was like, you know what?
No.
If we lose this thing,
it's not that valuable.
It just wasn't meant to be.
But can we expect the Glockenfecken sweepstakes for that sperm that's hidden somewhere in the sperm bank?
I think it's destroyed now. Yeah.
Sorry, ladies.
Man, that would have been a great fundraising opportunity.
Only we'd have the foresight.
Very strange. But no, it was like maybe 2 years, and then eventually we were like, you know what, we're complete. Like
it helped that good. By the time he had it the second time, I already was done. The shop was closed.
Yeah.
So like, he needed a little more time to kind of mentally process that and get there as well. So I said, if this will help, let's do it. And we have this as an insurance policy. That's totally fine.
Here's another interesting thing is to get your sperm destroyed. Your sample destroyed, you gotta like go to FedEx and have something notarized by the FedEx employee. So I went in and was like, brought a form, is like, I need you to sign this for me.
Really do want this sperm destroyed.
So can you help me destroy my sperm, please?
And they sent you to FedEx
worker. Well, because they have at these post office type places, they're like notaries there.
Yeah. Okay.
And so I needed a notary to do this.
So I think this is a great time for potentially a PSA, Will, for people like Kevin and myself and all of our male listeners. How should we be handling our balls?
You know what? It's funny because every time I post about like checking your own testicles on social media, there's always somebody out there who's like, you know, the USTSPF or whatever it is, the U.S. Preventative Task Force, I don't remember what the acronym is, says that it's like a Class B recommendation that it actually doesn't help whenever you do your own testicular exam. Like basically trying to make the argument that there's no evidence to suggest that doing a self-exam. And my reaction to that is, like, these, we're talking about like young men, like they're touching their balls anyway. All the time. Like, what are you talking about telling guys not to like examine their testicles? We know our testicles better than anything else in the world. and so I say go for it. Absolutely. You should be very familiar with your balls.
You make me so proud. You know that.
Absolutely. Yeah. I don't care what anybody says. Be familiar with your balls.
So while Will was feeling his balls, Kristen, you have even a greater claim to fame in that you saved Will's life, literally saved his life. And I think a lot of people have heard about this if they follow you on social media, but could you take just a moment to tell everyone what happened and what was going through your mind during the event? And then since then, what have you, you've spoken about this and you've mm-hmm. done educational material and all of that. So yeah, please tell us.
Yeah. So I don't know, 3 or 4 years after the second round of cancer, he had a cardiac arrest in his sleep. It was May of 2020, the night after Mother's Day, because he has real cool timing like that. And he was perfectly healthy. I mean, aside from the two cancer occurrences, but he was, as far as we knew, very healthy and still young. He was 34. And he just, in his sleep, his heart stopped beating. And I am not medically trained or inclined in any way. And so being when it was May of 2020, early in the COVID pandemic, I heard what I later learned was agonal breathing, but I had no idea what that was. And I just heard him making these really weird snoring sounds. And I was just, it was like 4:45 in the morning. So I was real groggy, right? Just like startled awake by these noises. And I thought he was just snoring and, you know, but eventually I realized that he wasn't responding. And so I called 911 and I was thinking COVID, you know, because it was this respiratory thing that I was hearing, and just there's no history of any sort of, you know, sudden cardiac arrest in his family or anything like that. So it just did not cross my mind and I did not know what was going on. So the dispatcher knew what to do and she told me to start CPR, and I was like, okay. And just did what she said. So I did 10 minutes of CPR. I couldn't move him off the bed. I'm like more than a foot shorter than him. Yeah. And I had had a cervical disc replacement just 3 or 4 months before that. So I'm hypermobile. So, you know, just the combination was great. But I couldn't. I just couldn't move him off the bed. I was worried about hitting his head on the nightstand if I tried to drag him, and if I hurt myself, then I couldn't help him at all. So she told me just to do it on the bed, so I did, and thankfully it all worked out. But paramedics came, kicked the door in, did all the things. They shocked him 5 times and gave him a bunch of other stuff and took him off to the hospital. So
And now she, you know, we talk about this when we do, you know, when we do speaking events, and it's really powerful to hear Kristen's account of it and the advocacy that we've done together and she's done on her own, you know, for not only survivors or CPR, but also the people that do the CPR, because that's often
all the attention in the cardiac arrest space. Around advocacy, it tends to go towards teaching people CPR, and that is absolutely very important. And let's do that work. And I try to contribute to that work as well. But we're now in a situation where there just didn't used to be survivors of cardiac arrest, and so, you know, the attention was all on, well, let's try to get more survivors. And the good news is we we have. There are more now than there used to be. And yeah. And but what that does is it opens up this kind of second step in the process, which is, you know, there are people along with the patient, right? Like this is a whole step of survivorship. And the patient has a lot of things that they don't get any support for right now with regards to survivorship, but also the family members, right? It happened to them too. And they definitely have no support right now within the healthcare system. And then even if you're not a family member, if you're just a witness or if you are a lay responder, whether it's someone you know or not, if you're not medically trained, this is very traumatic. Like the things that you see and hear and feel and do when you're doing CPR, it is gnarly and it's brutal. And, you know, add to that, that it, statistically speaking anyway, it's likely to be a loved one, right? So you're doing all of these things on someone that you love. I mean, it's just very traumatic. And it sent me into, a very weird space in my head that took me a while to find my way out of. But yeah, just in the moment, you know, I was just thinking of us as college kids, you know, when we met and started dating and everything, you know, that we've been through from then until now, and just all the hard work we've put into building a life together. And now here it's finally like we're settled and we have kids and we're doing it, right? We finally get to do it.
She's thinking about the mortgage I almost left her with.
We had just gotten a mortgage 1 month before.
And I tried to check out.
Yeah. And so. I was like, no way. You're not leaving me here with two young kids to raise and this mortgage. Like, you're just not allowed. So get back here. But yeah, you know, kind of your life flashes before your eyes, so to speak. But it wasn't my life necessarily, but it was together. Our life. Yeah, yeah, it was my kids and our marriage and just all of the things. And so I was working as hard as I could.
Incredible.
So, yeah. So I have two follow-up questions to that. Had you ever done CPR, learned CPR, done BLS, anything like that? And the other question is what was his status when he left the house? Was there signs of life? Where do you think he was going off to the hospital to die? Like where, you know, what was that situation?
Yeah. I had never done CPR before. I had had one training. In college, I'd had an after-school job that dealt with childcare, and so I had to get CPR certified for that. And I would imagine there was other BLS training along with that, but I don't really remember. Thankfully, it's not very complicated, right? I didn't realize I needed to do it. That was the problem. So I was really glad that the dispatcher did realize that. But once you're doing it, it's not that, I mean, it's physically difficult, like in terms of it's very tiring, but it's not like a physically complicated maneuver or anything. So, so luckily it was something simple enough for anybody to do, as long as they're physically capable. But,
then for me, whenever they took
when you left, you were not conscious, but they did get his heartbeat back in the house before they took him. And
they were able to intubate me and start an IV and all that stuff.
Yeah. Do you want to tell the story?
Those are the thing I know.
Well, what else? I mean,
just trying to be helpful.
He was unconscious. What does he know? No, they got his heartbeat back and they took him off. He was kind of batting at things, you know, kind of showing some signs of purposeful movement, but wasn't conscious at all. But yeah, he was kind of pulling at his tubes and things like that. I didn't get to see, right? It was COVID, so I didn't get to go with him.
Oh, goodness, yeah.
Yeah, and that was another super traumatic thing that I think so many people in the country right now in the world are dealing with, of being separated from their loved one in these really, really traumatic life and death situations. But yeah, he was showing signs of life and health, and then they did all the tests and he was totally healthy and they couldn't figure out why it had happened. Everything was structurally and functionally as normal as you would expect. So,
Is it thought to be related to the chemo?
No, he never had to have chemo.
Never had to have chemo.
Oh
yeah. So, we don't know. We don't know. It's
and not
it's
COVID vaccine related.
I do. I have a subcutaneous ICD, which I got put. I normally think what happens is if this happens to a young person during the hospitalization, they'll just do the surgery. They'll just implant the ICD and at that during that hospitalization. But that couldn't happen for me because all the outpatient surgery got shut down because of COVID. And so I actually had to wear the life vest. You guys have seen the life vest, like the external defibrillator, the bra thing, the electric bra. Yeah. So I got to wear that for a few days. I don't know how long it was, probably like a week.
It was 2 or 3 weeks.
Yeah. So for a while and too long, I had to wear that thing until I was able to get a surgery to get the ICD placed. But yeah, and it hasn't gone off, knock on wood, but yeah.
Now, when you have an experience like this for, I mean, both of you, you know, this has to change your outlook to some degree. And and maybe you want to talk about that. But also, what I wonder is, do you ever feel guilty if you're getting back to normal and you'd be like, no, I have to remind myself that this is precious time, that I'm alive? Like, how does it change over time as well? Because at first, I'm sure you're just thrilled to be alive.
Yeah, that was the feeling right away. And that lasts for a while. And where you're just like every day, you're like, oh, thank God I'm here. I'm experiencing this with my family and my kids. And, but that feeling does fade, because you just end up into your new normal, but there's a lot of it that does still last quite a while. And it's stuff that you wouldn't expect, like, you know, not feeling comfortable going for a walk or a jog in places where I can't see, where there's nobody around me, you know, like feeling scared at times of like, you know, if it happened again and I collapsed, no one would see me or nowhere, you know, Kristen obsessively making sure that I have my phone with me anywhere I go. Sure. So there's little things like that, or just today, like I was downstairs on my lunch break and Kristen came home. And there was an ambulance on our street.
And the paramedic fire truck and the ambulance lights were flashing and it was parked right outside of our house.
So she called me, is like freaking out, like, you know, are you okay? So, you know, yeah, initially there's that relief for a little while, but then the long-term effects we're still feeling. And a lot of it's little reminders like that. And, you know, just still processing the fact that, you know, this could happen again. You know, I don't know. Yeah, I just, you have to live with it, I guess.
Yeah. You don't really move on from it. You move forward with it.
I don't think about it every day. The fact that I had a cardiac arrest. Sometimes I'll have moments or I'll have periods of time where I think about it a lot, but it's getting less and less, I would say.
That's interesting. Now, you guys have utilized your time doing some amazing things. And one of those is your new podcast, Knock Knock High. I've had the opportunity to listen to a handful of your first, I think you guys have seven.
Yeah.
Episodes out.
Yeah.
It's awesome. I've heard talk of vagina tears. We went you're breaking bad news and some really actual poignant kind of thoughts and recommendations on that. Severed fingers, challenges in rural medicine, untimely births. And you're all over the place. So tell us about the new podcast.
Yeah. So it's called Knock Knock High with the Glockenfleckens, which is a play on some videos I used to make where a med student starts a rotation for the first time and introduces themselves. And basically it's what we wanted to do with this podcast was show what we talked about earlier, which is that human side of doctors and other people in medicine and around medicine, to talk about some of the more off the wall, crazy, interesting, embarrassing things that happen to us in our daily lives.
Cause you guys get used to it, but like from my outside perspective, I'm always like, you know, this is not normal, right? Yeah. Like this is weird.
And with the idea being that we just show kind of that human side of being a physician. And also I try to take our guests a little bit out of their comfort zone from time to time. So, but that's the idea. And we have a new guest every day, every episode. And
We hear crazy medical stories, things that they have had to deal with on their side of the medical interactions, and then play games and have some fun too. Lots of laughs, but some serious things. I mean, we kind of go in and out, right? Of just,
and it's we only
in medicine, yeah, like there's positive and negatives, and so we're not afraid to do both.
And we only do a journal club like once every like four episodes.
So I have two questions as someone that is very dedicated to my podcast schedule and listening. How often do these come out, and what day do these come out?
Once a week. It's a weekly podcast, and it comes out on Tuesdays on YouTube and Apple. Pretty much. Wherever you get your podcast, you can find it.
Or there's a Patreon where you get early access.
Yeah.
Then they come out on Thursdays if you're on the part of the Patreon.
You're just dying to hear more of me and Kristen. So,
Everyone should definitely take a listen, and congratulations on already the early success with that. And it was a pleasure having you guys on Behind the Knife. And if you ever want to come back again, please do so. And please continue making this amazing content. We all enjoy it.
Thanks for having us.
Be sure to check out our website at www.behindtheknife.org for more great content. You can also follow us on Twitter at Behind the Knife and Instagram at Behind the Knife Podcast. If you like what you hear, please take a minute to leave us a review. Content produced by Behind the Knife is intended for health professionals and is for educational purposes only. We do not diagnose, treat, or offer patient-specific advice. Thank you for listening.
Until next time, dominate the day.